This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The 1980s was a decade of bloody mob wars in Philadelphia. It was also the decade when the mob was broken. My guest Frank Friel played a key role in convicting mob boss Nicky Scarfo of murder and putting many of his henchmen away, too. Friel is a former Philadelphia police detective who became the chief investigator and co-director of an organized crime task force jointly run by the Philadelphia Police and the FBI. The 80s started with the murder of Philadelphia mob boss Angelo Bruno, who was nicknamed the Gentle Don. His successor, Phil Testa, was murdered 1 year later. Then Nicky Scarfo became the Don, ruling over Philadelphia and Atlantic City with its new gambling casinos. Law enforcement authorities believe Scarfo authorized, participated in, or personally committed at least 26 murders during his career as a criminal. He was convicted of one of those murders in 1989. By the end of the decade, there were 60 other convictions in his organization. Friel has written a new book called Breaking the Mob. I asked him about the significance of dismantling the Philadelphia mob.
Well, there was a number of significant issues that we dealt with Nicky Scarfo and the Philadelphia mob. Number one, it was the first time in the history of La Cosa Nostra that narcotics had played such a significant role. The Honored Society, or the LCN, La Cosa Nostra, never involves itself with narcotics. What the convictions in the RICO case clearly established that the Philadelphia LCN was replete with their involvement in narcotics, starting with Nicky Scarfo himself and going right down to the street-level distributors. Another significant role of the convictions of the Philadelphia mob was the enormity of the violence that had been perpetuated on the streets of Philadelphia, going back to the assassination of Angelo Bruno in March of 1980. When you consider the relative numbers of the mob, knowing now through breaking the mob that the membership never exceeded about 70 made members, and some 35 made members and associates were slaughtered in the streets, it was a significant turmoil. The enormity of the bloodshed would date back to Chicago in the Roaring Twenties. Those are very key, significant areas. And of course, with the conviction of Scarfo himself for first-degree murder, that certainly established a landmark in regard to the ability the law enforcement has to come together to join forces in targeting a significant violent head of La Cosa Nostra. And that's exactly what had occurred here in Philadelphia.
From your vantage point as a Philadelphia police officer, one of the significant aspects of this case was that the FBI and the Philadelphia police worked together. Why is that so unusual, the FBI and the police cooperating in a case like this?
It would stand to reason, and I guess it calls upon your concern for common sense that law enforcement works together to target, in the interest of society, a common element, which is the criminal. Unfortunately, what occurs frequently is each individual law enforcement agency becomes so caught up with their primary responsibilities that the obvious sometimes is overlooked. In 1982, the FBI took it upon themselves, because of their frustration with solving organized crime murders and the Philadelphia Police Department's frustration with the lack of the ability to solve these murders, the special agent charge, John Hogan, and the head of the organized crime component in the FBI, Dennis O'Callaghan, visited Commissioner Solomon in the Philadelphia Police Department and broached the concept of sharing information.
Did this bring up differences in how the FBI and the police go about doing the job of collecting information?
Oh, I think so, yeah.
What were some of those differences?
Some of the differences were that the Philadelphia Homicide Division works with absolutely no funds in the sense of paying for informants' information. We have no funds as far as establishing safe houses, provide vehicles, that type of fund, or limited funds. The Organized Crime Squad, through the FBI, had funds that were sufficient to induce people to come forward to give us essential information that led to the clearing of many of these homicides.
The FBI had more money than the Philadelphia Police ever did for buying information. What does information go for?
Well, it depends on the nature of the crime. I've seen $25,000 paid out for information which led to arrest of two very high-profile murderers for a single bit of information. And there's a graduated scale depending upon the value of that information to law enforcement.
Do you pay in check or in cash?
In cash. People that we deal with rarely accept the check.
My guest is Frank Friel, and from 1982 to 88, he was the chief investigator and co-director of the Philadelphia Police FBI Organized Crime Task Force in Philadelphia. And he's written a new book called Breaking the Mob about the cases that broke the Philadelphia mob. There were mob wars going on at the time that you were investigating the Philadelphia mob, a lot of violence, a lot of murders within the mob. Why was it such a tumultuous, violent period for the mob in Philadelphia?
I think it was a characteristic of the transition between a relatively docile reign of Angelo Bruno, who reigned between 1959 and his assassination in 1980. Not that homicides were not committed, but they were not committed with the frequency or the level of violence or the type of homicide was not committed. So it came to the attention of law enforcement and to the public in general. They were few and far between, meaning homicides were few and far between. After Angelo Bruno, then Phil Testa succeeded Angelo Bruno. He was assassinated within a year, almost at a corresponding date on March the 15th of 1981. With Testa's death, then Nicodemo Scarfo was elevated to the position of Don of La Cosa Nostra, the Philadelphia South Jersey family. And a level of violence was increased that Philadelphia had never experienced, probably no major city in the country had ever experienced, going back to the wild and rip-roaring days of Prohibition in the 1920s. Everybody came under his scrutiny, meaning everybody in the mob or the associates who were not paying either tribute, they were not being extorted. Even petty rivalries that existed prior to the time that Scarfo was a mob. At this point in his life, he decided to be very, very vindictive, and it cost these people who had offended him literally generations ago, their lives.
Was this a good time for you to try to break the mob, a time when there was a lot of violence within the mob?
It turned out, coincidentally enough, to be very fortuitous for law enforcement when you could focus on something as catastrophic as a number of human lives that were being lost, not only murdered but left on the streets for the citizens in general to view. Then it was a clear mandate that law enforcement better do something about it. It also created a lasting impression on the mob members themselves that the slightest wrong, whether real or imagined, committed in the presence of Scarfo may cost them their lives.
In Philadelphia, RICO was used to break the mob, the Racketeer-Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act. How did that help you make the case? What did RICO give you that you wouldn't have had before in breaking the Philadelphia mob?
One of the benefits for law enforcement for the RICO concept is that you don't have to prove the elements of a single crime. So it afforded law enforcement to bring in the totality of the crimes that this La Cosa Nostra family was using to the detriment of society. And of course, we were able to bring in some 9 murders, the attempted murders, the extortions, the loan sharking, the gambling, the narcotics into one case. The overwhelming nature of this evidence, the admissible evidence, was sufficient in this case to produce beyond a reasonable doubt the guilt for the jury to accept and move forward with their guilty verdicts. We had tried prior to the RICO to establish beyond a reasonable doubt Scarfo and his henchmen's involvement in the Salvatore Testa Commonwealth case of murder. We were not successful in doing that because we were only permitted to introduce, of course, those elements that were on trial, and that was the Testa case. With the RICO, we were permitted to bring in all the elements, the organization, and that's what this is. This is a corrupt organization. La Cosa Nostra, and this in Philadelphia's case, was a very violent organization.
As the co-director of the Organized Crime Task Force, one of the things that you did was to turn mobsters. One of the people who you tried to turn into an informant and I think finally succeeded in doing was Mario Riccobini, whose half-brother was Harry the Hunchback,
yes,
Riccobini. And to try to convince him to give you information, you brought in his wife and his daughter.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And what happened?
Well, I thought that I was very persuasive as far as ultimately what the penalty for Mario would be. We already had arrested Mario on first-degree murder. We had a warrant, a valid warrant. We had information that he participated in a conspiracy that led to the assassination of the consigliere, which is the counselor of the Philadelphia mob, a fellow by the name of Frank Monti. We had admissible evidence indicating that we could move forward with this trial. I approached him. He agreed that probably if a deal could be worked out, meaning that he would testify truthfully in exchange for consideration of sentence. But it was still a tremendous thing for him to overcome because there is an oath of office that these gentlemen take or the participants take, and it's a tremendous difficult time for them to get over, to cooperate. All their lives have been involved on the opposite side of the law. They're criminals. And to broach the concept of now cooperating with the enemy, meaning law enforcement, is very difficult. One of the things that I thought would make it easier for him if his family came in to say, you have to do this for us. So I brought in his wife and I brought in his daughter and gave a very persuasive and I believed at the time eloquent speech in the interest of this family. We could keep this family together in time, although Mario would have to go to jail for his crimes. But somewhere in the future, you could see the light at the end of the tunnel. I was absolutely devastated to learn that his daughter was not so accepting in the eloquence of my speech and the prospect of having the family together, but she much preferred to enjoy the status of being a mobster's daughter in South Philadelphia, which is the area that the mob in Philadelphia primarily controls. And her principal concern was not being able to go back to the local beauty shop, not being able to go back to the local pizza pie place where she was regarded as almost a princess, you know, to use the phrase mafia princess. She was had that status. She had the recognition. She had the name. She was somebody's daughter. If that person turned out to be an informant, then she wouldn't enjoy that. And her principal concerns was for herself and not for the welfare of her father.
So what did you do? Get the family out of there?
My jaw dropped down to my kneecaps, and I had to separate the family from this ongoing dialogue, and I brought this young woman out and tried to be, again, very convincing in the interest and welfare of her father. Father certainly had provided a very nice lifestyle for her up to that point. And I explained to her as best I could that the ultimate penalty here, and this is a capital offense, we're talking about first-degree murder, was her father would be electrocuted, and that she should give due thought to that and balance the two concerns that she had, her status at the pizza pie parlor and her father's life. She was intractable. She said, he was born into this. This is what he meant to be served. He knew the risk getting into it, and he should do what he has to do, keep his mouth shut and go to prison.
So what was the outcome?
Well, the outcome was I thanked the family for coming in. I thanked them for their participation. I sat down with Mario again, and I explained what his options were. Mario was not a stupid man. He's very intelligent, as a matter of fact, and he opted to do the thing that would guarantee that he would be back with his family sometime in life. He guaranteed that he would testify truthfully for law enforcement, and he eventually did two significant murder trials here in Philadelphia.
One of the things that you would do while you were heading up the organized crime task force was drop in on the organized crime bars.
Mm-hmm.
What would you do when you get there? Order a drink? Talk to people?
You would go around. You would see who was there. You would recognize the relationships. It's a very formalized structure in who talks to who. It would help you identify who the movers and shakers were. And after that was firmly committed in your mind, then yes, that's exactly what myself and other members of the task force would do, would go up and strike up informal conversation. They knew who we were, obviously. Of course, we knew who we were. They were. And it was through that you could start to break down some of the resistance that prevents you from gaining any insights into their personality, finding where the vulnerabilities were. And it's that was exactly the purpose of this, see who was out at what hour, what place they frequented, who was with who had loyalties to somebody else over here, if you could, certain conversations that would lead you to believe that suspicion existed between these people who were there and other members of the bar. Guys who would remain together, you'd knew that you're not going to separate them. Guys who were distant from each other, maybe drinking at the same bar but at different ends of the bar, you knew you could probably drive a wedge between. And the whole purpose of that was to gather intelligence, plant seeds, talk on an informal basis. These guys get to know you in a less threatening manner.
Who would possibly talk with you in a mobster bar with everybody else watching? Everybody knows you're a cop.
A lot of times people, they become more loud and more garrulous. They become, they want everybody to know, since everybody knows who you are, that they're not talking about who's committing what crime. But one of the characteristics that I have found with certainly the Philadelphia LCN is there's many, many members who are absolutely charming people. I don't want to create a wrong impression. I mean, they are murderers, and we've established that beyond anybody's doubt. But if they were not murderers, as far as their personalities were concerned, frequently they were very charming people and would give the impression that they wanted to help you. But it would be clear and it would be loud, so everybody with an earshot would know clearly what they're talking about. But what the benefit for law enforcement is that you get to be known, and you get to know the personality, and you can walk in on somebody. And somebody who's seen talking with you is not immediately under suspicion, because people have seen and heard those conversations before.
So people didn't walk out and leave when
they
you walked in?
They didn't walk out and leave, no. Not all the time. This was their turf, and that was one of the things that you wanted to clearly establish. You're coming into there, you're with hat in hand, you're looking to establish a relationship. And not only the mob members themselves, but hangers-on, which were very, very informative as far as law enforcement is concerned.
How many drinks could you have and still feel like you were being productive at the bar?
I'm a nurser. You know, you get a bottle of beer and you walk around and you sit, and you, as long as you have that bottle and beer in your hand, then you're fine.
It's been said about the Philadelphia mob that never before had so many members of the same organization come forward to testify against a former associate, Nicky Scarfo, who was the head of the mob. Why did he command so little loyalty from the men? I mean, let's face it, organized crime, there's the oath of silence, and here you have so many people coming forward and turning or testifying.
Because he was treacherous, and he was recognized as treacherous. There is no honor among this group, among the La Cosa Nostra families. Once again, it's predicated on somebody's willingness to commit murder, and frequently of their closest friends, and how you do that is you stab them in the back. But the level of violence that Scarfo introduced to the Philadelphia family was unequaled in La Cosa Nostra history. Consequently, it made it not easy, but maybe relatively easy compared to other organized crime families, because his own members knew they could not trust this man. The own members knew that it was only a matter of time before some insignificant slight may result on a contract on their lives. And at first, it was tremendously difficult to gain credibility with the mobsters itself, but with each successful prosecution that we had, each time we treated an informant fairly, someone who would come forward and testify, we sent a message to the mob that they didn't have to be murdered, that they did have some place to go. And this exactly was the principle that we were operating under.
What's left of the Philadelphia mob, and who has filled the vacuum?
The Philadelphia mob will remain. As far as the leader of the mob, it's probably a gray area now. Scarfo will continue to lead a mob until he's considered so vulnerable by the existing members that they'll no longer follow any of his lead. And it's not an unusual event that a mob boss can continue to rule the mob from prison. But basically, what law enforcement in Philadelphia has done was destroy the infrastructure of the mob, destroy the people who were valued and experienced employees of La Cosa Nostra at each and every level, starting from the boss to many, many of the soldiers. And the soldiers are the people that the boss depends upon to actually do the job. He remains insulated. So uncharacteristically of law enforcement success here in Philadelphia, we've destroyed their ability to maintain an ongoing organization. But we would be very naive indeed to believe that we've destroyed La Cosa Nostra here, because this is an organization that has literally survived for some 2,000 years. And there are those that have remained untouched either by homicides or the success of law enforcement, who wait in the wings to come forward to determine how deeply they'll become involved and who will be the next leader.
Frank Friel is my guest, and from 1982 to 1988, he was the chief investigator and co-director of the Philadelphia Police FBI Organized Crime Task Force in Philadelphia. He's written a new book called Breaking the Mob. There's another part of your story that you tell in your new book, and that's a story of you actually trying to get somebody off murder charges.
That's correct.
Who was the person, and why were you trying to get him off?
We had a double murder that occurred in Philadelphia in one of the downtown restaurants called Melita's Restaurant in 1981. It was just the beginning of the slaughter of mob figures on the street, where two masked gunmen entered this restaurant and shot a number of people at the table. They shot two people. Both people died. Through the course of the investigation, a fellow by the name of Neil Ferber, who had a long history of criminal involvement, but minor crimes, was arrested, tried, and convicted. His sentence was two death penalties, one for each one of the murders. He had lost his appeal, and he was waiting on death row for the execution of his sentence. Through my involvement with other organized crime homicides, as the task force developed credibility in mob circles, I began to get feedback amongst the mob who knew the actual circumstances of this crime. These people were telling me, this is a mafia murder, and the guy that you guys have on death row is not the guy. So that struck up my awareness for the potential that we had an innocent man on death row.
So what did you do to try to get him off, and did you succeed?
I investigated the elements of the crime, who most likely would have been the participant as opposed to this fella. And yes, I was successful after a long, torturous period of getting this guy out. And eventually the authorities recognized, and we recognize today, that he was wrongfully convicted. It was a long, torturous process, and frequently the system is not geared up to recognize its mistakes because it's so difficult to get someone convicted. The standards of admissibility of evidence are very, very high for that reason, because we don't want to convict innocent people.
But why did you persist?
I persisted because it became an obsession with me. Once I became the recipient of the information from my mob informants, who now had a lot of credibility with me and looked to me to do something about it, because they become very moral. Once they flip, then they give you all the information that they have, and it fell on my shoulders to move this case forward, to clearly establish that the system had failed and it was up to the system to rectify the error. And ultimately, that's exactly what happened. The system broke down because this fellow was wrongfully convicted. But it was the system itself that got through the Philadelphia Police Department that got this guy off of death row, and he walked out a free man.
What do you think other cities with organized crime problems on their hands could learn from what happened in Philadelphia?
I think the basic principle of the lesson to be learned was to recognize that there exists a law enforcement community, and it's a valuable community. When you strike out on your own, then you don't have the resources that are available, even the large departments like Philadelphia, New York, Chicago, because we are so self-sufficient. We believe that we are the end-all and the be-all, and a lot of times we're not open to suggestions from other law enforcement agencies. When you open your mind, when you go with your hat in hand to another law enforcement agency like the FBI, which of course is a nationally professional organization, and say we need help and we're willing to accept it.
You retired from the Philadelphia police force. Do you ever run into any of the mobsters and informants that you dealt with over the years in Philadelphia?
I get a call. I have an open line for these fellows that I've convicted, and my secretary marvels frequently of my remaining in contact with these people. But again, it's a matter of credibility. We have steered them through a very, very treacherous period of time in a murky waters of what ultimately will be the remainder of their lives. I'm not in a position now where I'm willing to cut them off. When they call up, it's a lot of time just to chat. And it makes them feel good to know that somebody within the system still remains in touch with them, even though their term is still largely in front of them. It gives them a basic semblance of belief in the system of individuals, that policemen are not robocops, that they're not machines, that they are human beings capable of feeling, having empathy and sympathy for their plight in life.
So what are they called to talk about?
Well, they talk about whether or not they think it's premature that they should appeal to the governor of the state to reduce their sentence. They talk about contemporary issues in the news. They're very well read because they have a lot of time on their hands. And what ifs? What ifs? It's always what if. What if I didn't testify? Could I be the mob boss today? You know, what if I wasn't going to get killed? What if I didn't do this? What if I didn't do that?
And you reassure them?
I reassure them, sure. I bring them back to reality. It was a very violent time. The potential for that violence to continue was there as long as Scarfo was in the head position there. And it remains regardless of who may assume the leadership role, depending upon the individual characteristics of that person, violence could return.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure.
Frank Friel was the chief investigator for the Philadelphia Police FBI Organized Crime Task Force. His new book is Breaking the Mob. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.